Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. I'm Scott Harris. This week we present Mel Goodman, a senior fellow at the Center for International Policy and former CIA analyst, who expresses grave concern that Trump's threat to invoke the Insurrection Act will hasten the demise of U.S. democracy. Danny Choi, a furloughed federal worker at the Department of Health and Human Services, who talks about what's at stake in negotiations to end the government shutdown for workers like him and essential government services for millions of Americans. And Dr. Crystal Cavalier-Keck, co-founder of Seven Directions of Service, who summarizes presentations she made on the rights of nature during recent Climate Week events at the United Nations in New York City. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
On September 27th, the Indian government detained the leader of a movement seeking more autonomy for Ladakh, a small but strategically important region in the Himalayas with a population of 300,000 people. The leader, Sonam Wangchuck, was arrested 2 days after India's Ministry of Home Affairs accused him of fomenting mob violence, comparing the struggle in Ladakh to the recent violent anti-government Gen Z revolution protests in neighboring Nepal. The region has become a flashpoint for India's territorial disputes with both China and Pakistan. Prime Minister Narendra Modi's government brought Ladakh under direct federal control in 2019. At the same time, he revoked the volatile territory of Jammu and Kashmir's special status. Ladakh activists initially welcomed the change, expecting to see a move toward autonomy and development, but they soon grew impatient with a lack of progress. Wangchuck was engaged in a 2-week hunger strike seeking full statehood for Ladakh when clashes broke out between protesters and the police, killing at least 4 people on September 24th. Anger is boiling over in the University of California system as administrators turned over 160 names of students, faculty, and staff to the Trump administration under the guise of investigating alleged anti-Semitic incidents. The disclosure of the names comes as the Trump administration targets elite universities attempting to force administrators to adopt the president's MAGA political agenda in exchange for access to federal funds. Some observers compare the government's threats against universities as a clear violation of academic freedom and an echo of the repressive McCarthy era. Judith Butler, a UC Berkeley philosophy professor and Jewish critic of the Israeli government, said there is no good evidence that anti-Semitism is rampant on campus, and added that opposing genocide of Palestinian civilians in Gaza is certainly not an act of anti-Semitism. 600 university professors from around the world who have worked with faculty at UC Berkeley signed an open letter addressed to UC President James Milliken and UC Berkeley Chancellor Richard Lyons criticizing the process, where those whose names were shared with the Trump regime did not have a chance to dispute the information the university has collected. Heather Honey, a high-profile denier of Donald Trump's 2020 election loss to Joe Biden, has been appointed to a senior position in the U.S. Department of Homeland Security, in which she'll now help oversee the nation's election infrastructure. ProPublica reports that Honey is a protege of Cleta Mitchell, a lawyer who worked for Trump to overturn the 2020 election results. Working with Mitchell, Honey played a key role in the behind-the-scenes effort in 2024 to change Georgia's election rules to allow Republican Party officials to contest a potential Trump loss in the state that year. In his second term, Trump has gutted the budgets and fired hundreds of employees at 3 federal cybersecurity programs at DHS designed to shield U.S. elections from foreign interference. David Becker, executive director of the Center for Election Innovation and Research, said the cuts had dismantled nearly all of DHS's capacity to protect election infrastructure, and instead is hiring a conspiracy theorist with no election expertise, showing DHS may become a primary amplifier of false election conspiracies pushed by our enemies. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Anna Manzo.
Over the past 8.5 months, Donald Trump has on an almost daily basis implemented policies that blatantly defy the U.S. Constitution, the Bill of Rights, and rule of law. Masked ICE agents, acting as a secret police force, employ brutal military tactics to abduct non-citizens and citizens alike, denying many their due process rights to carry out Trump's mass deportation campaign. At the same time, Trump has weaponized the Department of Justice to investigate and indict his perceived political enemies, and he's ordered the Pentagon, renamed the War Department, to deploy the National Guard to an ever-expanding list of U.S. cities. After troops were federalized and sent to Los Angeles during the summer, defying opposition by California Governor Gavin Newsom, National Guard were then deployed to Washington, D.C. In recent weeks, Trump has ordered more National Guard soldiers to Memphis, Portland, and Chicago. While a federal judge has temporarily blocked Trump from deploying National Guard troops from Texas and California to Portland, another judge declined to block the president from sending troops to Illinois, pending a ruling. However, Trump ordered Texas National Guard to Chicago, despite the judge's warning not to do so before the ruling was made. On October 6th, the president said he's considering invoking the 1807 Insurrection Act to bypass courts, state and local officials who oppose his plan to militarize U.S. cities. Your reporter spoke with Mel Goodman, a senior fellow at the Center for International Policy and a former CIA analyst. Here he expresses grave concern that Trump's invocation of the Insurrection Act will escalate the president's attack on Americans who he labels the enemy within, and hasten the demise of U.S. democracy.
Well, it's very clear that they have a playbook. We have no reason to be surprised or shocked by any of this because he's told us what he's going to do. It started essentially with Homeland Security sending ICE agents to targeted cities. The targeted cities were essentially major cities in blue states, usually mayors of color. That was certainly true in the beginning with Washington and L.A. It'll be true for Chicago. These agents are masked and they're armed. Whoever thought we would see masked agents in American cities? They're using tear gas. They're using chemicals. They're raiding homes. They're rappelling into apartment buildings. That looked like a scene out of Fallujah. You know, at the wars we fought in Iraq, Afghanistan, it was hard to believe that this was an American city, particularly an American city as important as Chicago. And clearly, their role is to provoke demonstrations. What Trump has already done is exaggerated the scale and the severity. He's referred to Portland as war-ravaged, which is ludicrous. Chicago, he's called a crime-ridden war zone. And now the president and the Secretary of Defense are in a position to deploy federalized National Guard troops. Apparently, they're destined to go to Chicago. They've already been denied by the courts a position in Portland, Oregon, but Trump keeps changing the terms. If he can't get the federalized Oregon National Guard, he went to California. When he couldn't get that, he called out the Texas National Guard. And, of course, Abbott was only too glad to accommodate that request. And the judges who stopped this were referred to by Stephen Miller, who's the fascist leader of this plot, as being guilty of legal insurrection. That's a new term. The judges who've ruled against Trump are guilty of legal insurrection. And the end result of all of this, I think, was to invoke the Insurrection Act from 1807, something that he wanted to do in the year 2020, when you had the protests in Minneapolis following the brutal murder of George Floyd. So with the Insurrection Act, even though he's already doing what he wants to do, he could act with impunity, and he could circumvent the Posse Comitatus Act from 1878, which prevents the use of the military in domestic situations. So with the Insurrection Act, he'll be able to deploy the military, he'll be able to federalize the National Guard, and he'll have a statutory exception to the Posse Comitatus Act. And what I worry about, because people are counting on the courts to confront Trump in this way, I think the Supreme Court particularly will look at this as a national security problem, and they will defer to the president. You're getting some good decisions from appeals courts and federal courts, various state courts, but when it goes to the Supreme Court, where he has this 6-3 majority, I don't think he has any real concerns. I think he's very confident that the Supreme Court, on national security grounds, will support the president. This is terrifying to me, what's happening in this country and how quickly it's happening. I worry particularly, and this is my final point, that we do have these national protests scheduled for October the 18th. Will this be the justification for finally invoking the Insurrection Act?
Well, we only have a minute or so left, Mel, and I did want to ask you one important question that could be a longer conversation, but just your quick take on this. When the U.S. military, active duty soldiers, National Guard, whoever they may be, they swear their allegiance to the Constitution, not the president. And as I understand it, they have an obligation to disobey illegal, unconstitutional orders. And I guess the big question is, will a majority of the military turn their guns on people of the United States in cities that they're now deployed to, or will they disobey those orders under their right to not abide by unconstitutional and illegal orders to harm fellow citizens?
Well, I served in the Army for 3 years. I taught at the National War College for 18 years. And I've always argued there's a difference between battlefield courage and physical courage, as opposed to political courage and the need to stand up to illegal orders or authoritarian commands. So I would not count on the military to block what Trump is trying to do. And what I fear is you get the military in the streets. They're not trained to deal with protests and disturbances of this type. When Secretary of Defense Mark Esper was asked by Trump, can't you shoot these protesters? You know, you don't have to kill them. You can just shoot them in the legs. Esper stood up to Trump. Well, there's no way that Hegseth is going to stand up. And if we're counting on the military, these generals and admirals, not to enforce illegal laws or orders, I think we're going to be disappointed. What concerns me now is, where are the retired generals, former chairman of the Joint Chief? Why haven't they been writing op-eds? Why haven't they been taking a stand? They know how dangerous this is. The state of Illinois that we're worried about now, where's Barack Obama defending the state of Illinois? Why hasn't he been more active? Why haven't a bipartisan group of former presidents, you know, Clinton, Bush, Obama, spoken out? You know, where's the public outcry? That's what I find so frightening.
That was Mel Goodman, a senior fellow at the Center for International Policy, a former CIA analyst, and national security columnist for CounterPunch.org. Find a link to his recent commentary titled Setting the Stage for the Insurrection Act by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. As the shutdown of the U.S. federal government entered its second week, Donald Trump threatened to block furloughed federal workers from receiving back pay once the government shutdown is over. This comes on top of earlier Trump threats to enact mass firings of federal workers if Senate Democrats continue to block Republicans' efforts to pass a temporary funding measure to reopen the government. Thus far, Senate Democrats have refused to vote for legislation to reopen the government unless it includes a commitment to extend expiring Affordable Care Act health insurance subsidies, which, if not addressed, will increase monthly premiums for more than 22 million ACA enrollees by 75% to 114%. It's estimated that if rates rise, some 2 to 4 million Americans will lose their health insurance altogether. Danny Choi, a federal worker at the Department of Health and Human Services, is one of 620,000 government employees who've been placed on furlough since the shutdown began on October 1st. Your reporter spoke with Choi, who works at the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services in New York, and is a member of the American Federation of Government Employees Union, about what's at stake in negotiations to end the shutdown for workers like him and essential government programs that serve the needs of millions of Americans.
I think the threats of not providing back pay that was in law in 2019, as during the previous two administrations ago, and the idea that the staff reductions that are proposed during the shutdown, something that can be passed and is legal, is a very troubling idea for a lot of federal workers, such as myself. And I think personally that all these different headline items are scare tactics to, one, cause federal workers to be less willing to speak out. For example, two whistleblowers from the Housing and Urban Development were fired a few weeks ago based off of their whistleblowing of sharing how the Fair Housing Act was not properly being supported because of staff reductions. And you can look at that report. Federal Unionist Network put something out regarding that. There's a lot of different ways in which we have seen as federal workers different scare tactics that are employed to make us afraid to be willing to speak out. And that just shows that what we say has credence, right? And it's showing that the simple story that the healthcare is provided to legal immigrants is a very catchy headline. But the truth of the matter is that ACA, the Affordable Care Act, does not cover folks that are non-citizens. However, there is some truth in that people, no matter what their citizenship status, do receive emergency care in hospitals as part of EMTALA Acts. You may hear a little bit about that. And hospitals are required, if they want to participate in a Medicare program for CMS, they're required to provide emergency services no matter who shows up. And I think that is a sign of the American spirit in how we think about compassionate healthcare. And how I think if anyone is talking about healthcare and talking about providing Make America Healthy, we need to think about how emergency care works. And essentially, you don't want to say that we're going to close doors to someone that doesn't look like someone else or for any other reason, right? So I think that is a more complex and important topic regarding how healthcare is. But essentially, a lot of what was said prior is not true. But there is some truth to the importance of how healthcare is delivered in this country.
I wanted to ask you, Danny, what do you think the Trump regime's long-term goal here is in these severe cuts to all kinds of federal programs, their budgets, their staff, eliminating entire agencies without the consent of Congress? And the Supreme Court has apparently let that go, this extremist wing of the Supreme Court majority. What do you think their end goal is here? And what are your worries about our country in terms of the services that you provide at Health and Human Services and the countless other agencies that are really being hampered in terms of their ability to provide services?
So many of the services and benefits that people receive from the federal government are invisible. They will always continue to happen regardless of things that are happening in D.C., things like SNAP, Medicaid, Medicare, and things like that. But what we've been seeing this year, which is extremely concerning, is that in prior administrations, we have not seen changes to Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid in this kind of way. And now we've seen this approach in which leads to concerning impact. Like, for example, Social Security having extremely reduction in call center staff so that their ability to manage cases for folks that need support and maybe they have a missed check or some other concern regarding the Social Security benefit. And even though they're in shutdown, actually, some of these cases are being slowed down and not well managed. Same thing goes for anything like the Veterans Health Administration, right? So many of these different agencies that people typically would not dare, like, because they're such politically important groups and services, now nothing is off the table in a sense, right? So there's like a wholesale targeted approach across many different benefits that many people benefit from. And because of that, I feel that many Americans and also folks across the country are going to feel the impacts more so. Some, it will take longer. Some happen through administrative changes, right? Like say, work requirements and things like that. That will affect people in a way that's not directly impacting them, but creates administrative hurdles, right? So people have a tougher time accessing the benefits. And in this sense, some of the impacts may be invisible. Some of them may be more visible, like Head Start and things like that. So I think the way in which government is being shrunk, it's not really for efficiency, right? This is really trying to provide less services. And these are things that Congress, remember, many years ago, has agreed in a bipartisan manner to do these type of programs, right? So this is stepping back from the congressional promise of what they are trying to provide to the American people. And I think that's a really important thing to remember, is that this is not really a partisan issue. This is something that government made a promise to the people that elected them there to do certain things. And right now, we have a shutdown because those things are not happening. And we're trying to figure that out.
That was Danny Choi, a furloughed federal worker at the Department of Health and Human Services, a Marine veteran, and an activist with a federal unionist network. Learn more about the government shutdown and the plight of federal workers by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Climate Week took place in New York City this year from September 21st to the 28th, just before the annual meeting of the United Nations General Assembly. Just like at the annual International Climate Meetings, known as the Conference of Parties or COP, Climate Week has been infiltrated by the corporations that are largely responsible for creating the climate crisis that these global gatherings are meant to address. Their fossil fuel companies make side deals with governments and multinational corporations like Coca-Cola and Nestle that siphon huge amounts of water from the neediest populations are also on hand seeking endorsements for what they say are their sustainable operations. But Climate Week still offers grassroots organizations a platform to raise the visibility of issues such as climate justice and indigenous rights. One of these groups is Seven Directions of Service, an indigenous-led organization rooted in environmental justice and grassroots power, operating on the ancestral homelands of the Okanichi Saponi in rural North Carolina. Its mission is to protect sacred places, advocate for the legal recognition of rights of nature, and establish a land, language, and cultural center grounded in traditional Yesa teachings. The group is committed to serving as a powerful voice for the lands and waters beyond a solely human-centered view of the world. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Dr. Crystal Cavalier Keck, co-founder with her husband Jason Crazy Bear of Seven Directions of Service. She made four presentations during Climate Week at the UN and summarizes the information shared here.
On our first one, we talked about United Nations sustainability, and that was talking about how we were going to get the climate goals that the United Nations has put out to how we're going to be able to meet these 2030 sustainability goals. And I just really don't think we're going to be able to meet these sustainability goals because of the United States' global reach. So we're going to have to come back to the drawing board. But then also hearing President Trump at the United Nations was just a travesty, because he's not really out here trying to nation build with other nations. And just hearing him just spill out this rhetoric, it's, well, number one, it's embarrassing, because I'm just having this secondhand embarrassment. Like, how could he just sit on the world stage and say these things? And I don't know if he believes it or not, but God, he looks like an idiot, right? And I'm just like, this is who we have representing us, and it's embarrassing. The second one was talking about moving towards a rights of nature based in our legal way. So just changing the way we think legally. We are looking at these things as not as resources, but as responsibilities, right? So change the way you look at a dandelion, or change the way you look at water, because these are gifts that was given to us, or you can't exist without these things, right? And that's what I keep saying about people are not looking at the bigger picture. If Bayer owns Monsanto, and those are two things, like they have a pharmaceutical company and then you have a toxin company. The toxin company is killing off herbs that get rid of cancers. versus buy all of these cancer drugs that people can't afford anymore. You know, if you incorporate those dandelion leaves into your salad, you know, it helps your body release the toxins because it's a bitter leaf. But when you have things like this fighting against each other, it just cancels out the everyday people. I just think back that we have elected these leaders to speak on our behalf and make the big decisions. That's why we're able to live our life. But now we're getting in this because he's not representing us. So we talked about that, how we're going to bring control back to our communities and how we're going to have to live it in a different way. So all of our communities together can unite and work together when we're trying to fight about issues. Because if we bring it back to a responsibility to protect what's sacred, like the earth and the water and the air that we breathe, then we will be able to understand that all of these things are a gift. The next one we talked about, the Gulf South to Appalachia, just to talk about all of these pipelines, oil refineries, the petrochemicals, all of these environmental harms that's happening. We have to come together and fight back because it takes the frack gas to fuel these petrochemical plants that makes like everything that's in like some type of plastic bottle, right? And saying that we have to work together. And then the last one at the United UN Climate Week, we worked with Movement Rights, and they're our partners when we talk about the rights of nature. And we talked about how we really needed to dismantle and get off this fossil fuel, because when you extract so much from the earth, not only are you doing a disservice below the surface, you will deplete whatever is in the earth. And so we were talking about that and how we need to bring in traditional ecological knowledge and elders from the community and just really think about this in a common sense way, in a sustainable way that's going to sustain us to live on this earth before we destroy it.
That was Dr. Crystal Cavalier Keck, co-founder of Seven Directions of Service. Learn more about the group and the issues they work on, as well as other UN Climate Week events, by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs and streaming audio and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Blue Sky at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WESU in Middletown, Connecticut, WXDR in New Orleans, Louisiana, KMXT in Kodiak, Alaska, dozens of other community radio stations across the U.S. and abroad, and wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.